If you've listened to any of my archives, John Foster is a UFO experiencer. He's in his 80s. There's now a film, 90-minute documentary about his experiences with ETs, the phenomenon. Given the fact that it was decades of experiences, there's a lot to that story. There's also a promo, a 10-minute segment that was previewed by the Omaha UFO Study Group. Steve Snodgrass was a presenter for John's information. He's known John for decades. So I asked him to fill us in on the background.
There's sort of this dual aspect to experiences. On one hand, there's this fear, tremendous fear over having loss of control, anxiety, depression, and just negative emotion. But then conversely and simultaneously, euphoria.
I'm talking with Steve Snodgrass, and you know John Foster. I wanted to talk to you because there was a presentation recently that is giving people an idea of what this upcoming documentary is going to be about. And you did the presentation. Just tell me more about what you saw and about your experiences with John Foster, the whole nine yards. I'm really looking forward to seeing the film, for one thing. And if you could introduce it to us, I'd appreciate that.
Sure thing. You know, along the way during the development, it was this past summer that we, due to COVID, had been shut down and hadn't done one of our annual UFO symposia at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. And so I was asked to give a presentation on John Foster. I'd only touched on it on one of my presentations, you know, 14 years ago. And so I got to thinking, what would I want to do? What do the people want to hear? What should they hear? Knowing that my approach has been, I guess, in terms of the UFO community, a little bit unorthodox, which how do you be unorthodox to a UFO community?
Yeah, how does that work?
What I decided to do is absolutely I wanted to share John's experiences, but only would probably have time for two or three of them. I ended up covering two in very brief experiences, what he calls simple experiences. And then I covered in more depth two of his experiences, the Bethany grade school encounter, the Dillon Lake, which was shorter than the Sheridan Fire Guard Creek story. So what I wanted to do was kind of intersperse what John's experiences were, and then look and reflect on my background and my understanding in terms of science articles, in terms of philosophy, in terms of psychology and neuroscience. How or in what way could these experiences that John had be possible? How could they be plausible to the point that they probably did occur?
For someone who's just becoming familiar with these kinds of experiences, John's runs the gamut. He has sightings, he has details of the dates, the times, and witnesses, which other people don't have. So how did you approach it?
Going back and looking through John's books and reflecting on my interviews with him, of course, I would have started with a biography that was his biography that he wrote about himself. So John Foster, born October 1937, was now in 2024 here, aged 86, is, in his own words, a retired research and development electrical and mechanical engineer with experience in the nuclear, aerospace, fluidic, civil, and commercial fields. A home builder, general contractor, artist, lecturer, and author, here's what he writes. Up until 1986, at age 48, I could recall some strange things that had occurred from my very early childhood, but I really couldn't understand them. Then in late 1986 through early 1987, in a very short time, I recalled in extreme detail an enormous number of so-called UFO encounters that had occurred throughout my life. I became almost totally devastated. My entire life was turned upside down. A few witnesses have since recalled some of what I recalled, enough to convince me and them I am not psychotic or imaginative. I have spent the last 30 years researching, writing, and trying to understand. The mysterious intelligences connected to my encounters have told me that they are the monitors and keepers of the earth, and are responsible to a hierarchy that includes the archangels Michael and Gabriel, who are responsible to the entity we have known as Christ, who is in charge of this corner of our immensely complex universe. They explain further that they are not allowed to interfere in the affairs of humankind, except at certain times when things are going awry or are dangerous. They said this is one of those times, one of those eras. They continued to state that if they had not interfered in the past, we would have destroyed ourselves. If they do not interfere now and in the future, we will indeed destroy ourselves.
That's the introduction for John Foster at the Omaha UFO Study Group. And Steve continues.
I reflected back on the conversations that he had had with Dr. Leo Sprinkle, who described John as being courageous and determined and willing to share his doubt. The evaluation he had with Dr. Fowler Jones out of the University of Kansas Medical Center declared him not psychotic, no delusional disorder, but most likely an abreaction to a traumatic experience. And so this is not unlike what John Mack, the famed Harvard psychiatrist and controversial one, had described. I have known John as, I guess, in a couple of different ways. In some ways, his experiences are common. And what I mean by that is he's reluctant to share. He's fully aware of the consequences of not speaking and not voicing what happened to him, since it was so profound. It's also common that he absolutely wanted to know what happened to him with all these experiences. And then in some ways, what I found to be common, although I was corrected recently, there's sort of this dual aspect to experiences. On one hand, there's this fear, tremendous fear over having loss of control, anxiety, depression, and just negative emotion. But then conversely and simultaneously, euphoria. And I don't mean a drug-deranged euphoria, but an absolutely profound and meaningful and single most important thing that ever happened in his life, and he's got to communicate it kind of thing. What I've found in John that's uncommon is his self-reflection, having come from might as well be hard sciences, materialistic science, and his engineering background. He reflects a lot on his own, am I mad? Was this imagination? Did this actually happen? Were these dreams? You can sense his warmth, his genuineness, and the consistency in his story. And having met the man, I'd ask viewers to look for themselves. Does it look like he has an appropriate affect? And what I mean by that is when he gets emotional, is it appropriate to the situation? So here we have a scientifically minded individual who wants to get the story straight. And what's remarkable with him compared to some other accounts that I've heard is he takes great care as sort of a stenographer to describe, you know, here's what did happen. Here's what I do remember. I did feel, I did see, I did hear. He takes just as much care and attention to that as he does what he didn't hear, what he didn't remember, what he didn't experience. It's as if, as he describes things, any derailment from what actually happened seems to be, from his point of view, a betrayal. Like, I'm betraying everything that happened if I don't write down exactly what happened to me.
I think that's very valid. Because anybody can remember something, and then as the years go by, you misremember, you kind of, you know, put things all together, and all of a sudden, it's a different story. He's tried, I think, meticulously to document and write his memories down so that he could go back and frame it the way that he believes that it happened in the best possible light and not change it. And that, I think having, is it three books that I know of that he has that document this story, he's tried to be as explicit as he can in terms of this is the site where it was, the so you can actually go out and visit the site, like you're talking about places you are familiar with. And then he also tries to do the dates, the times that he would have had that experience, and then what happened when he remembered. All of that is incredible detail that a lot of experiencers aren't able to do. I think because of his engineering background, he had an advantage.
I think that's absolutely the case. And it's why, insofar as he... His experiences spurred him on to try and get an answer to his question, what did happen to me? Writing down as much of a factual account of exactly everything that he did and experienced and felt. He devotes an entire different volume of book. Okay, here's where I'm going to speculate. Here's where I'm going to start to use some imagination and do research on history and symbolism ancient civilizations and try to come up with some way to wrap his head around what did it all mean. So he has a whole separate volume devoted to that, and then the other volume was just an illustration picture book. I guess we're so fortunate to have John as an engineer be an artist at the same time. And his pencil drawings and some that I just saw from this film that are actually in color for the first time that I'd never seen. Most of them were just black and white pencil drawings that I've seen. So we're just really fortunate to have his artistry to kind of paint a picture of what he experienced.
When you gave the presentation, and this was recently, this was at the Omaha Study Group and the UFO Study Group Symposium, you also saw the film, but you also were there with the people, the reaction. What was it like for John, the people who were present at that meeting? What was the reaction?
You know, it's interesting. I wasn't sure the audience reaction because I know UFO enthusiasts like to be, that's maybe not fair, they appreciate the stories, the what happened, and in some ways, the more outstanding and incredible they are, the more engaged the audience could be. Well, John's story certainly serves that purpose. What they weren't prepared for, I don't think, was my attempt at trying to justify in what way and in what universe could we live in where mainstream neuroscience and experiments that suggest that we can have a different perception of our body location and our agency and ownership of a human body, what John described as out-of-body experiences, how those sorts of things happened, and what is the process of thinking and feeling in states of consciousness, and how do you know if something's a dream versus something that's real? And really, I tried to balance out was my approach with that, and I wasn't sure what the audience was going to react to it, but I think it fired him up a bit. I think it fired him up a bit in terms of, no, wait a minute. I thought I maybe came here for entertainment. This is not entertainment. This is serious. Mm-hmm. This is,
yeah.
Well, wait a minute. Are you saying modern neuroscience can support some of these experiences that John had? And that was the goal of my presentation, was to share some simple and complex experiences and try to justify them in light of some more scientific and I guess in some cases, pseudoscientific research where people don't want to touch. So people wanted to know, did this actually happen? Was he abducted? And of course, my answer was based on my understanding and my interpretation, it's not that simple. Reality isn't that simple. The nature of our universe and what we're figuring out in quantum physics, the nature of perception and the mind and consciousness is a hot topic in neuroscience. Nothing about his experiences could I easily say, well, yeah, sure, he was abducted. Well, you know, what does that mean? My answer was really, it's not that simple. So in some ways, maybe I frustrated the audience.
I think we're still struggling with what is physical and non-physical and OBEs. Some of the experiencers have said, I was out of my body when I went with whomever. Can you address that?
Well, and maybe I should cover first. What I started with was, no, wait a minute, this wasn't a psychotic or a delusional disorder. How do you know that? And how do you know this is just an abreaction to trauma? One of the first things I did was shared what we know about memory. And memory, if this is where all of John's experiences, most of them occurred from, now, wait a minute, how do you know memory is faulty, right? And so what I first did was just a short walk through what we know about memory, about human perception in the first place, and how trauma impacts. And what we find in research on memory is that memory is a very complicated affair that runs through a number of different brain systems, from our sensory apparatus to the hypothalamus, which kind of determines here's what's important to remember and here's what's not. It's really a process. And it involves an encoding process. Emotions are heavily involved. Movement and motor operations are really important. So when the fight, flight, or freeze response, something unusual, out of the ordinary, I wasn't expecting this, occurs, what we find is adrenaline. The adrenal glands will start to produce adrenaline. And what adrenaline does is enhance memory encoding. And this is really important. I need to pay attention to this. What can happen is memory can occur in flashbulb memory, or I guess in two different ways. If you look at flashbulb memories and then fragmented memories, you'll get bits and pieces at or near or surrounding a traumatic event. And so what I tried to show was, here are flashbulbs, images, pictures of the craft, of the beings, of the elongated saucer, of the coffin, of the teepee, of the tent, and all these images that are just kind of freeze frame that could be justified as flashbulb memories. But then, okay, why doesn't he recount everything fully? And why does his daughter, Kendra, who I know you've interviewed, how does she not remember the same sort of thing? Well, it depends on your state. Perception of any object depends on your state. For example, the one I used in the talk was, I had just eaten a gigantic steak at Texas Roadhouse with all the sides. And after eating that steak, then I walk into a Casey's and I look at the pizza. Well, usually when I go into Casey's and I look at the pizza, I get hungry. Well, that pizza did not look appetizing. You know, your perception can change based on what your state is at that point. So that's the first thing I did, was try to justify how John Mack looked at these experiences, as it's not a psychotic or a delusional disorder that caused John to recall these things. There are events that occurred, and the way and the manner in which he recounted them as memories is consistent with what traumatic experience and traumatic memories look like. I can go on to out-of-body experiences now, but I wanted to pause and see if you had any questions about that.
No, that's great. I like that. And when you're talking about the flashbulb memory and the fragmented memory, that's excellent. And the adrenaline boost that helps sink the memory into place. There's a huge difference. If Kendra had the experience and she was just kind of going with the flow and in it, that's a dream state where things are just normal and she's calm and her adrenaline is just, you know, there's nothing there to trigger that. I think that's a huge insight into that. So continue with the out-of-body experience, because that's where it gets a little bit more complex when people want the physical encounter versus the, well, you were just in the OBE state. Well, there is a difference, but I don't think that makes it any, I don't think it negates it.
Right. And so the first thing I did was I took people to the Dillon Lake experience, which was in 1975 that John recounts. As I look at the Dillon Lake experience and the drawing that John has of a man in a cowboy hat, his description of that event is him and his two daughters were out there. They're noticing the craft as well. And he hears this voice telling him to pop out of his body. And then he describes how he was reluctant to do that, and they threatened him, basically. If you don't do it, we're going to do it for you, as part of his education. And then he notices himself swoop out, his center of location swoops out of his body, moves forward, moves backward, and then is situated about a foot or two off the ground. And so what I did with that was, oh my goodness, well, how are we going to look at out-of-body experiences? Is there any way in which those things that people have reported could happen? And so I found an article that they've been researching on virtual reality since 2001. They've been doing this, measuring perceived location in virtual reality. And the way the experiment works is they'll have you stand before a video screen with a headset on, and before you in the headset is an image of an avatar that's supposed to be you. And in this experiment, what they would do is stroke your back in different motions synchronously at the same time with you observing the same virtual controller in the video of your avatar being stroked back and forth. What they find is, in only a matter of 2 minutes, by the synchronous stroking of your back with your avatar in the front, you have a variety of different experiences that project your sense of location, so your physical sense of location, your agency, which is your ability to move the body. You have a sense that you can move that body. and your ownership of the body seems to have switched to, now I own this other body over there. So I almost likened it to, you know, if you've ever played Donkey Kong, you're watching Mario climb up the ladders to try and avoid the barrels, and a barrel kind of crunches down on you and you crouch.
Yeah.
You know, you get that sense or that feeling that you're crouching. And so really this study was fascinating, and they've continued to do this. We see nothing but virtual reality simulations right now. And the idea that that an out-of-body experience, one that's just as legitimate that way, could be provoked or prompted in only 2 minutes of synchronous stroking of your back at the same time, just lends some support for out-of-body experiences. Now, whether you can see different things from a different location is a whole other matter, but the typical stories of people in surgery, are they able to see things from a different point of view and count the number of the people in the room? That will certainly remain a mystery, but in terms of your self-location is changeable, it's malleable. You never really we can't pin down. It's as if the body is always trying to locate itself in time and space. And the one other aspect of this study that was interesting is they would do a locomotion effect. So the locomotion effect involved for you to sense where your body was, and if it changed, we're going to back you up. So have you walk back about 6 feet, and then we're going to have you walk back to where you think your body was. Well, it didn't work. It didn't work when you got the somatosensory feedback from your nervous system and your muscles that basically just relocated you back in your body, whereas if you're motionless, you don't move. And he described the image of himself there as being motionless and absolutely still. Can you provoke an out-of-body experience in that way? So as far as I was concerned, there is some support to out-of-body experience in virtual reality that we've been exploring in science.
Robert Monroe, who has done a ton of research, the Monroe Institute produces hemisync materials to help you achieve the out-of-body state and the, you know, going into the consciousness and study consciousness studies. A lot of validation right now that is a real state. And I've had my own experiences where I was in more than one state, as a matter of fact, in three places at one time. And in addition to also being in the out-of-body state where I was just above observing myself. So for me, those things are real. Now, John has his own experiences and the own entities that he deals with, so that's unique. But I'm just saying, having been able to, for myself, validate that is a reality for me, I think science, like what you're studying with the virtual reality, is getting a step closer to saying this is something that we can expect. And it isn't a dream. It isn't a fantasy. It's another state of awareness or consciousness that each of us might be able to access. Does that make sense?
Yes. Well, and just to take this out of virtual reality for a moment and to put it into mainstream neuroscience, Antonio Damasio is a very well-respected neuroscientist, and his work, one of his books is called Self Comes to Mind. Here's the idea. How can living matter that is unconscious all of a sudden become self-aware with qualities and experiences and the feeling of being nauseated and things like that? Antonio Damasio's work on what a proto-self would do, a brain system that's devoted to how does the complexities of the brain operate in such a way that a self can actually come to a mind with its own sense of physical location in time and space. I did, like you, have some experiences whenever you get interested in a topic. Well, I wonder if I could do that. I had some initial interest in Shirley MacLaine. That's what kind of got me started way back in the 1980s with her book Out on a Limb. And she described her out-of-body experience and a silver cord and things like that. Mm-hmm. Well, and as interested as I was in that, you know, dreams are often a way to play those things out. And I would notice myself in a lucid dream state and have the sense that I was out of body. And I wanted to verify it. And so I was lucid enough in the dream that I didn't want to be distracted by phenomena, but I wanted to test it. And so what I was able to do, to the extent that I could control this, maybe called virtual self, was I would go over and look at a clock and then wake myself up. In a lucid dream, you're able to wake yourself up.
Yeah.
Well, Wendy, I'm sorry to say, every time I did that, I woke up from my dream and it was a completely different time of day. I was actually taking a nap during the daytime, and the clock would read it's midnight or 1 a.m., and I was never able, even with lucid dreaming, to be able to kind of verify, now, wait a minute, was I actually in 3D physical space and time, and was I out of the body, and could I see something from a different point of view in a room? So I would try to test it out over and over again, and if anybody has any lucid dreaming abilities and out-of-body experiences, that's what our study group did at one point, was just in our classroom where we met on campus at the Durham Science Center. On top of the cabinet, we would just have a sticky note with some shape that one person would write and put on the top, okay, anybody, if you think you can out-of-body travel, next time you find yourself in that state, go up to the top of this cabinet in the room and tell us what that image said. That was a good way to test it, we thought. Well, nobody was successful. So we try to rule things out as best we can, because this universe is so mysterious in the first place. We want to at least keep our heads on straight as best we can to try and demonstrate something. And it tends to be so difficult.
Some of the research they did with SRI, that when they were doing the Stargate program with the CIA, and Robert Monroe is actually part of that, helping them with some of these things. But Pat Price, I remember, is one of the psychics involved, and he was somebody who was able to, it might be called bilocate, but he was able to project his consciousness to a space and bring back information, and one of the best that they had. Others who could do that, Ingo Swann was one of them, and the takeaway from that is not everybody is somebody who would be a professional. I'm not so sure that we can, all of us, immediately have that ability to, with very little prep, very little experience, very little practice, do it immediately. I think that's somebody who's at the avatar level of being able to, the master level, I should say, practice, and assume that, okay, eventually I will improve as I become more aware of what it takes. There are some people who do the out-of-body, and they'll stop themselves when they get into the vibration state where your body just starts to vibrate. It's like, oh, oops, wake up. I'm one of those. You know, it's like, oh, no, darn it, I stopped it.
Right.
It's like, darn it, don't do that. But it's hard because, you know, that's unfamiliar. And it's like, oops, I shouldn't be doing that. And it's like, well, that's not the way you want to do it if you're going to be, not everybody, but that vibratory state is and the precursor to the out-of-body phase. So I just, you know, I think we're still learning. So in other words, don't discount yourself because you guys weren't able to do it. Okay, just continue to do it. Maybe, you know, a few more years and somebody, one of you, might see what's on top of the cabinet.
In fact, any bit of data is what I'm interested in. The fact that I couldn't do it according to my own expectations was not an attempt to debunk. It was an attempt to try and determine, okay, what is this state? And how does the dream state correlate with something else? And the more I've explored this, and I guess in some ways to just jump to the end, what I ended up doing with John's work in looking at supporting what telepathy looks like, what is the feeling of being stared at, what's the nature of meditation, what does that serve, what are these telepathic messages that he had to go in for conditioning, and looking at cognitive neuroscience, what I come to understand is that all of these mental things that we're very familiar with, all our executive functioning skills, every aspect of that are mental processes. And what I mean by that is your perception is a process. Memory is a mental process. Your self-location is actually a process. Your ability to decide how you control your body is a mental process. Your visual attention and your intentions are all mental processes. What that means to me as I reflect upon that versus this 3D reality of actual objects, are there actual physical objects out there? And what we're calling into question right now, even in, I would call it basic mainstream physics research and quantum physics, is it suggests that, well, we either have a bunch of physical objects that are bumping into each other that are arising from some quantum mechanical scattering amplitudes, that's how they're described, or philosophy approach called metaphysical idealism. So either this world is made of a bunch of physical objects, and what reality actually is just a bunch of physical objects bumping into each other in very complex ways, or does this universe consist of nothing but mental processes? And if so, what does it look like when mental processes are bumping into each other? Are we in some mental realm of possibilities? Does that mean that we are simply sharing and receiving information and experience such that the nature of 3D reality is in physical objects? This challenges that notion, and it ends everything. Whether or not somebody was abducted, whether or not you can actually locate something in an out-of-body experience as if this waking state is actually the real one, is irrelevant according to this view. It's my expectations, my intentions, perhaps, that allowed me to see a clock that wasn't accurate.
Steve Snodgrass, my guest. The John Foster documentary will be 90 minutes when it's concluded. The producer of the documentary is Rhett McClure, and that 10-minute video presentation is also posted on his site. When details are available, I'll post those too. Right now, the links I have are posted in the description for the show. A quick break. Steve Snodgrass thinks some of the current research supports John's story.
I know I get asked here speculating, and this is where I don't know that people really appreciate it. Was John abducted? Well, it's not so simple. Are these mental processes that bump into each other? Did John's interest in being contacted result in what manifested as craft out of fog and haze and beings who had both telepathic and audio messages and things like that? And what is the nature of time travel? Because John describes in depth time travel experience as well. So I really have backed up from this quite a bit and have not looked at this as just among any other UFO ET encounter story. But if I'm to believe the man, I'll say one more thing. We just had Easter weekend, and in the works of C.S. Lewis, in describing Christ and did he resurrect and was he who he claimed to be, and C.S. Lewis had the line, well, he's either a liar, he's a lunatic, or he's the Lord. And some modern atheists would describe that as, well, maybe it's a legend is the other L. I don't find John to be a liar. I do not find him to be a lunatic. I am not equating him with the Lord Jesus Christ. But what is his message if he's not a liar or a lunatic? What, as an authentic scribe to an actual experience that he had, what does that mean about the nature of reality, and what is it, and who are we? Where are we come from? Why is there something from nothing? All these deep philosophical questions present themselves in my imagination as I look through John's story.
What I think is so fascinating, and you touched on it earlier, is the euphoria. When someone has an encounter or an experience that is beyond belief, beyond what we consider to be our normal and everyday reality, there is a sense of, oh my gosh, and that euphoria, that adrenaline, that thing of, I want to share this, and then not being able, especially from his community, and when he was going through this earlier, 1986, when he first had all the download memories, all of a sudden, his world was shattered. And there's that same thing of, I had the experience, but oh my, what am I going to do with it? Because this makes me crazy. That is one of these stories that goes along with experiencers who try to share these incredible awakenings, I call them, that reality shift that says something happened to me that I don't know how to deal with, and I'm going to have to figure out. In a lot of ways, integration of that stuff takes years, sometimes decades.
Yes, if your expectations are the world is a certain way, or even if that comes down to you expected your spouse to behave in a certain way and your kids, and your world can get blown up. Not just by a UFO or an ET experience. Absolutely, that is absolutely a transcendent, world-shattering experience that would justifiably put people in a position that they'd want to explore it. But as I would try to relate that to Say when I'm going to work, I have a plan and an expectation that I'm going to follow the rules of the road. I'm not going to speed because I got a $240 ticket once. I'm not going to do that anymore. And I expect my car to work. It's a conveyance and to get me from point A to point B. And I have all my expectations of what's going to happen when I get to work. And then my car breaks down. My whole world immediately shatters. And maybe I'm exaggerating that, but what does that mean about what I'm supposed to go to work today? Did I buy the wrong car? Am I just a stupid idiot for buying a vehicle that I forgot to do this or to get its maintenance done? Am I going to be able to pick up my kids on time? You get this cascade when things don't go your way according to your expectations, a cascade of plan changing, let's call it not world shattering, but plan changing things. Mm-hmm. So if you imagine that multiplied by 1,000%, a contact with an alien intelligence, a non-human intelligence and craft that manifest in and out of haze and fog and disappear and have weird symbolic messages, it's no wonder that a typical reaction to that would be, what in the world has happened to me? And I've got to figure this out.
The other thing about John's experiences and going with the presentation, this is going to be a 90-minute documentary, and what you saw was just the 10-minute intro, kind of a preview teaser. The familiar strangers that John mentions in his work, the fact that he wasn't alone for a lot of his encounters. Now, whether the others remembered, like his daughter, whether they remembered that or not, or his wife, the fact is he did remember it, and it did sink into his consciousness, and he's able to tell the story. The familiar strangers brings in some others who also were present that John knew or met or connected to afterwards in a way that validated his own experiences for him, which is also at that time kind of frightening, because then it became real and, you know, you want to know, okay, I'm not crazy. Well, I'm still not crazy, but maybe what the heck, it's real. And then that takes it into a whole different dimension.
Oh my goodness. I'm so glad. That was one of the questions after my talk. One of the first questions was that I mentioned in the talk that he had corroborating witnesses. Some of the people have come forward. They don't all remember things the same way he did, but enough people have come forward, including his daughters and his wife, to hint that there were some of those things that they experienced and were there and present at the same time and either couldn't remember or could remember and did share. So it's not just the corroborating witnesses that he describes in his books and has asked people to write, including his wife and his kids, write what you remember when he was sitting on the deck or on a second floor apartment in 1981 and said a quiet prayer and hoped that they might be interested in seeing a UFO. He was sitting with his son-in-law at the time, and both of them saw a craft straight forward, about 100 feet in the air, just a very brief experience, but they both went back in and told them what had happened to them, and of course nobody believed them, and from ordinary experiences like that, nobody's going to remember the encounters at the football games that he described in the middle of a Memorial Stadium, a craft or beings manifesting out of haze and fog, but there are enough corroborating witnesses that would really shock him. And then, yes, what John describes is the familiar strangers that he would recognize. You were on the craft at the same time. One of the people in the audience said, I was one of those people that he describes as familiar strangers. The producer of this movie had asked me, do you know if any of the familiar strangers are going to be there? And I told him, I have never asked John who they are. I don't know who they are, but there was one person who spoke up and described that I was there at the same time. I don't remember things exactly the way John did, but there was a moment of recollection. Another member of our group spoke up, and this was we did a video tour that's on our YouTube channel, where John took us around his experiences in and around North Omaha, around the Mormon Bridge, and there was a place called Power Landing where UFO enthusiasts and experiencers had been meeting. And when John would walk into a room, he would burst into tears, justifiably, because he would recognize some of the people were sitting with him in the room on the craft in one of these elongated large saucers. getting the same messages and they were there. He described them as familiar strangers. What you're suggesting is that would really be mind-blowing. Okay, it's one thing to have an experience and wonder about the nature of reality, but now you've got other people who are corroborating that. Absolute, and my goodness, what do you do with a case like that other than continue to spur you on to investigate it and find out what happened?
And why? And why? That's the thing. What is the purpose? What is the point? What's really going on? Because this is so mind-boggling, for one thing, and then to think, well, then there's some agenda, and whether the agenda is what they explained to John or a different agenda, because it might not be helpful to tell him the real story. You know, it's just all of those questions that come up with this, and finding out that there are more people who might not have had exactly the same memory of what happened, but the connection that, yes, I was a part of this, is huge.
Well, and the hierarchy or the brotherhood that he described, and them explaining what their purpose was, is to help humanity along one individual at a time. One of the messages that continued to be frequent and repeated was John was invited to go into these conditioning sessions, which he described essentially as learning how to meditate. They implored him to learn how to meditate, so to improve his spirituality. What I did was tie that to what we know of the function of the prefrontal cortex in human beings, is to manage seven different primary emotions and pause, and having the ability to think about your own thinking, think before you act, in this gap between stimulus and response. Here's an event that occurs to you, such as you're driving down the highway and somebody flips you off or cuts you off. You can pause a moment to think, do I road rage right now? Or do I imagine, boy, I hope everything's okay, that person seems to be in a hurry. The ability to pause for a moment and think before we act, and the depth to which a timeless moment of meditation can afford that, I can't think of a more positive and appropriate message for improving humanity than look at your own awareness. Look at your awareness from moment to moment and how thoughts arise. And when you try to meditate or just focus on your breath, notice how you're helpless from intrusive thoughts. Just, you know, you think you're just focusing on your breath and meditating, and the next thing you know, you're having an argument in your imagination with your significant other. And
whoops. intruder alert.
Right. And so that when I think about the messages that John received, the purpose for their communication, as they stated, is that they're here to help. They aren't here to hurt. They're here to educate. But learning is a painful and difficult process. And that's been one of my conclusions, I think, as I listen to John's experiences and how he's told them, is yes, there could very well be connections to legendary and history and ancient symbolism, and finding a common web in religion and spirituality. But in some ways, it kind of comes down to, we approach the world with courage and bravery. That's the only way to improve ourselves. It's painful to grow. And all of that is absolutely supported by cognitive neuroscience, I guess, is what I'd like to say. So whether you believe the alien beings and the manifesting in and out, I relate that all to what it must suggest about the nature of the universe. And I am coming down on the line of metaphysical idealism, that perhaps we don't live in a world of physical objects. We live in a world of mental processes, and we're just trying to figure out how to see things from the same perspective and move along and forward and make the world a better place.
I like the messages that John got. And I do think that there's more to this story, and the stories like experiencers who are at the level that John was offer a huge clue that it can change in an instant. When he says that the UFOs manifested out of the fog, that isn't an uncommon thing, but that suggests a dimension shift. It suggests something that doesn't mesh with our everyday physical reality, because there's another reality that's interpenetrating. Whether the language we have may change as we continue to explore and understand this and offer new dimensions of awareness and new language, new interpretations, new descriptions, because that seems to be what's happening. And it seems to be consistent because through the years, when you go back into the previous years, I mean, I even have a picture that from the Topeka Capital Journal of the UFO sighting they had back in 18 something. You know, it's like these things haven't just, the 60s wasn't the beginning of this, or 1947. It's been going on for a long time, and people have had experiences. We're just developing now some kind of a frame of reference that we can begin to see correlations and commonalities. And like Whitley Strieber, look, this is what happened to me. At first, he was frightened to death because of the image that he put on the book Communion. That's what he saw. John's images are a little bit disconcerting too. But at the same time, it's like, okay, we have to get used to seeing things that are unfamiliar, but delivering a positive message. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And when I look at one of the things that I shared in the presentation was when I had asked John, okay, tell me about these experiences. I know of waking, dreaming, and deep sleep states. What can you tell me about your memories? Did they appear to be memories from the waking state? Were they memories of perhaps a dream element? Or did they come from some deep sleep? What can you tell me about that? And he struggled, but his answer was that most of his experiences actually took place in at least three dimensions, and in many cases, what he called dimensional overlaps. He doesn't expand on what that means, but he was convinced the objects, the craft, the beings, the men, and this hierarchy are real. They're possibly who they say they were, mm-hmm. that they've been protectors rather than abusers, and they're here to help humanity. And what is in the 10-minute video segment, he's convinced that they have been here all along throughout the entire course of civilization.
Yeah, that's why I love his story. I like the fact that it has so many dimensions to it. It has the descriptions of the beings that he connected with and hearing the voices, and then hearing sometimes triggers of sounds that would indicate there was going to be something happen. And then when he describes it, an experience where everyone that he could see was frozen, all of a sudden, like suspended in time when this interaction happened. And then when the interaction had completed, everybody continued doing what they did. And so that would explain why some people see things and other people don't, because not everyone is there on the same plane and experiencing it. And maybe they're not meant to, is the whole point. So it really makes it hard when you're asking people, why do you believe? And then you ask somebody else why they don't and why they can't exist because they've never seen one. Well, that's maybe the point. You're not supposed to see one. It's like, well, darn, I'm not in that group. That what, you know, why? And that I think that's the question now a lot of people have is, how I want to see one. Why can't I? And well, are you ready? What will it scare you too much? And John's reaction after finding out he saw all these things wasn't exactly pleasant.
Yeah, be careful what you wish for. It continues to surprise me too, that what I appreciate about John's story is how consistent it is with Jacques Vallée, the French scientist who was portrayed in Close Encounters of the Third Kind as, wouldn't it be cool to have a French scientist? Jacques Vallée, well known in UFO history as a legitimate scientist, and even J. Allen Hynek, in his later parts of his career, they suggested that the idea that extraterrestrial hypothesis, the idea that these are actual beings and actual craft from interstellar space traveling to us, the evidence, the reports, including reports like John's, suggest that that's not what is necessarily occurring. There's probably what Jacques Vallée called something much more interesting about this phenomenon, based on the reports that he had, is that with defying the laws of physics and winking in and out of existence and time loss, he suggested, Jacques Vallée did, that it's about the nature of time is what these lessons are. We really don't know much about the nature of time in the first place. And Jacques Vallée authored or proposed the interdimensional hypothesis as an alternative to the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And more John's cases and others seem to line up with something like that much more than, was John abducted? Was it simply a matter of an actual craft from interstellar space that came down and visitors? There's just something much more fascinating and interesting in John's story and stories like it that point me in a different direction.
I think one of the things I kind of see that this parallels is people who can see ghosts or people who can see spirits of those who have passed on. And they can be in the same room with a whole bunch of other people and nobody else sees them. But if you can go back and corroborate it with by this was moving at that time, or here's the orb and this is the same place, the same direction, and even dogs, pets can tell you. I think that we're really close to understanding that not everyone has the same ability. And if they are right here, just like a ghost, just like someone else who is deceased, and yet they are being seen by those among us who are considered mediums, then the ET element would have that same kind of ability to be seen by some and completely invisible to others.
Right. You would think that what you reminded me there of just now when it comes to seeing spirits, if I follow through with what I'm saying with this universe is being described as mental processes, the feeling of being stared at is a very common, most people report that they have a feeling of being stared at, or if you're looking at someone and you try not to look at them to see if they might turn around and darn it, then they turned around and noticed you were staring at them, that there's been some research and studies on this. Some of the studies put it exactly at chance. None of them come in at less than 50% of the time. Can you guess whether somebody is staring at the back of your neck or not? But there's enough to suggest that people can learn this process, and some can have more of a hit rate of 80% if you can get good at sensing the feeling of being stared at. Now, is it that there's actually little of a force-carrying beam that emanates from the eyes? This is one of the things that I referenced in the talk, university studies on whether there's actually a force carrying beam that exits the eyes. What it suggests to me, if this is a process that can be learned, is that it's our mental attention and our focus and our intentions that do have this sort of field quality to them, not unlike a gravitational field that extends from this end of the universe to the other, but the electromagnetic field. I guess one other thought, as long as I'm on to the philosophy piece, Alfred North Whitehead was one of the philosophers that I quoted in my talk, and that this world consists of processes, not objects, not physical objects and things, but what this universe can is what quantum physics is suggesting. This is a philosopher who wrote back in the 1920s, that you don't contain, you don't produce thoughts and feelings. You don't contain them. You don't produce thoughts and feelings. What you are is you are thinking and feeling itself. You are a process of thinking and feeling. And to the extent that minds may not be limited to the physical body or the brain, but that every intention, every thought that you have is in some way shared or represented or illustrated throughout the universe, suggests to me maybe this is the possibility as to how contact occurs.
I think that's why the ETs are telling John to meditate, and that telepathy is a huge, our ability to improve that kind of knowing, that kind of awareness, that asset that we have. When you start getting into meditation, then you become aware of the thoughts that don't do you any service, the thoughts that are, yeah, you know, intrusive and okay. And once you eliminate that, you become more empowered and more proactive in your ability to choose an intention and stick with it. And that's some of the stuff that when people start working on manifesting, there are classes and have been classes for decades on how to improve your ability to be responsible in your intention, being proactive and eliminating things that are, again, going to prohibit you from creating the result that you are focused on. That, to me, is what the ETs are kind of emphasizing and saying, this is where you go forward. And John is just able to deliver that message in a way that also comes along with, and these are the other elements that go along with that. When you are learning, you're becoming more aware, and then society might push back because they're not quite ready to take it to that level.
Yeah, and here's John Foster, who didn't ask for any of this stuff.
No,
He's a research engineer, and broke horses in Wyoming growing up and cleared brush at the Sheridan Fire Guard Creek Cabin. Here's a hardworking man who didn't have any interest in spirituality, in UFOs. Well, no, that's not true. Let me take that back. He always had an interest. Who doesn't? Are we being visited? Is there life other than ours on our planet? And how could you not notice in the 50s, 60s, and 70s the UFO phenomenon? So he absolutely had an interest. But did he ask for all this stuff when it comes to Native Americans and Buffalo and a project to save?
Yeah, I don't think he wanted to be a star player. I don't think he wanted to be a star player. I think he was just happy to, yeah, I'm interested. That's really cool. And
Yeah, now wait a minute. You know, and at the same time, well, it happened. I'm not going to deny what happened to me. I'm not going to just sit on it. This is absolutely profound. I'm just going to write down everything I can remember. That's what he did. He wanted to know what the truth was. And the only way you're going to get at the truth is to pause and consider and contemplate what happened first and what happened second. And you can get the order of events all mixed up. And the more he dedicates his time to make sure he gets the story straight is what made him a really uncommon experiencer to me.
Steve Snodgrass, he was the presenter of the information for John when this 10-minute preview of the documentary was presented at the Omaha UFO Study Group. There's finally a documentary. This is a huge deal because John has had extensive experiences. And as an engineer, he's able to give us a detailed account. He includes drawings, descriptions of various types of ETs that he connected with. He also has drawings of the craft. He has locations, dates, the whole nine yards. An incredibly detailed experiencer story. I'll add links in the description for the show. The producer is Rhett McClure. I'll update with details about the documentary and when it will be available. I can't stress this enough. John's story is so unique because of all the details he's able to provide. John's experience lasted for decades. The memories of that, the initial memories of his encounter and the fact that he was connected to UFOs and ETs and all of that, because it was so outside his frame of reference and his ideology, his beliefs about life and what's possible, his heart shut down. He's recovered, obviously, in his 80s, but it's a story, unlike anything being told from the military side. The military side is dealing with the craft. The experiencer side deals with the occupants. And that's why it's so unique and important, because of the things we might learn. I really appreciate John for telling his story and being willing for so many years to try and get the word out from an experiencer's perspective. Thanks for listening.